Welcome to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Florida Bar Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law. With your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his field of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's program, Aerosmith's frontman, singer Steven Tyler, demands Trump to stop playing Aerosmith songs at his rallies. The band's 1993 hit, Living on the Edge, was played at Trump supporters entered the venue in Charleston Civic Center in West Virginia on August 21st, this month, this year, which has a capacity of over 13,500. Tyler has sent a cease and desist letter through his attorney citing the Lanham Act. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, Lanham Act.
Lanham Act. Some of these things.
He's really stepping away from the rest of the group of entertainers and taking that stand, huh?
But the Lanham Act, it actually prohibits any false designation or misleading description or representation of fact. In other words, the band does not want to be associated with Trump or a perceived endorsement, if you will. Intellectual property is a term that describes a range of rights in different aspects of business and products. And today, we're going to be talking about trademarks and copyrights with Florida Bar board certified expert in intellectual property law, David Loda. From Loda and Associates, PA. David is a registered patent attorney as well. But first, I'd like to welcome and introduce the legal panel for today. Gary Singer, good afternoon.
Hey, Phil, you know, Aerosmith, that was Love in an Elevator, right?
Love in the Elevator.
You'd be all about Trump.
The album Rocks that I grew up on, let me tell you. You know?
Seems like an odd choice to come out against Trump from him, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Also, as a special guest legal panelist, we have Josiah Graham from
Kelly Ustall.
That's a great firm.
It is. Thank you.
Appreciate you taking the time to help us.
I understand you're
a former prosecutor as well. Is that
yes,
really?
Sir. Yes, sir.
Wow.
Yeah,
for which office?
Broward. Michael Satz. I was a prosecutor
cool.
for 2 years here, state attorney's office in Broward County. It was a good time. We got a lot of trials, good training.
Sat on some big cases last year since you've been here.
Absolutely. Last year, I worked with the partner Eric Rosen, and we did 2 tobacco trials. Got large verdicts against 2 of the largest tobacco companies, Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds.
So really quick, funny story, then we'll get. But I was just at a motion calendar this week, and up in front of me, those are the really quick hearings for those who don't know, that you go out for like a really simple issue. Up in front of me was 2 tobacco cases kind of combined.
Yeah.
So the tobacco company had like 14 attorneys.
Oh, yeah, that's typical.
And, you know, wear $8,000 suits. And then they had, so they're going, the judge, it's all intellectual. Yeah. They finally get done. I go up, I'm like, "Here, hi, Your Honor, I'm here for my eviction." Tough act to follow.
Right. The important case.
I also like to welcome and introduce. Welcome and introduce to our listeners on 96.9 FM, 103.9 FM, 7:40 AM, along with our national listeners on iHeart, TuneIn, and iRadio Now. Good afternoon.
Hi.
On Thursdays at 5:30 PM, just Google Facebook Legal News and Review. We're recording live at the Kelly Ustall Building in their mock courtroom. You know, Kelly Ustall Law Firm is committed to helping you seek justice. Just go to justiceforall.com. That's justiceforall.com. Attorneys all over the country refer cases to Kelly Ustall Firm, and it makes sense because of their resources, but their successes. That's when your fight really becomes their fight. Listen, if you've been severely injured because of negligence of someone else, please go to justiceforall.com. David, good afternoon. Welcome to Legal News and Review.
Good afternoon, Phil. Thank you for having me.
David, at the opening of the program, we reported about Aerosmith's lead singer, Steven Tyler, that demands Trump stop playing songs at a rally, and his attorney citing, and it's pronounced the Lanham Act.
It's the Lanham Act.
Lanham Act. Just say it right through. Okay. Please explain to our audience what that act actually is.
Well, the Lanham Act is a federal statute against unfair competition that would cause confusion in the marketplace or as to the source of a product or good, or as to affiliation or sponsorship by another entity. So in this case, Aerosmith was obviously offended that Trump's use of their song would create a mistaken identity or affiliation with Aerosmith, which is why they obviously sent that letter.
Really? Right,
which I would imagine he also addressed some copyright issues as well, because it would be a violation of the U.S. Copyright Act as well if they did not have permission to use the song.
Now,
if they
do, why would that not be fair use? You know, for example, because I don't think he was making money off of it.
You don't necessarily have to make money or profit from it. It's just the fact that if there's a chance of mistaken affiliation or sponsorship, then it would be a violation of the Lanham Act.
But what about the copyright part?
Now, the copyright
part... The Lanham Act, I can see.
Yeah, the copyright part actually is, I think, more clear in that the owner of the songs, Aerosmith, in this case, owns the copyrights, and they have the right to reproduce or... They have performing or performance rights with respect to that work. So here, the unauthorized use by Trump and his campaign to use Aerosmith's song without a license or authorization would be a violation of those rights to perform.
Even if Aerosmith, it wasn't like a commercial use?
Even if it's not not commercial use, it's still unauthorized.
So how far can you take that? So for example, if Aerosmith didn't live, if Tyler didn't like me and I was playing it at a party, could he tell me not to? Party I wasn't charging for.
Well, in that case, I mean, if it's a party not charging for, that would be fall into the fair use exception of the Copyright
Act.
So
why wouldn't
a
campaign rally?
Well, campaign actually, you know, you're looking to raise funds for, I imagine, for
next election.
The next election, you know. Elections of other in the same party as Trump.
So theoretically, if that was like a State of the Union type address, he could use it, then it would be fair use.
You're right. And it's not uncommon. I mean, politicians have routinely, going back to George Washington, has used music to promote their campaign.
Right? Wow.
Yankee Doodle Dandy and whatever other songs were popular back then.
We have musician friends and some even attorneys like Michael Santucci. We were talking the other day regarding when can you use music? When is the copyright out or up, if you will?
Copyright registration lasts, the rights to that work survive the life of the author plus 50 years following, you know, the passing of the author.
So for someone like Steven Tyler, that's like 400 years.
Right. Him and Mick Jagger.
Yeah. Have you seen those guys? They look like death warmed over. I mean, just saying.
So let me ask you something. I go on YouTube all the time, and I see just, you know, people, various YouTubers and bloggers just playing various music from other people, and they have like this disclaimer, and I'm not sure if it's actually legal, if it's grounded in anything, but they say such and such owns the copyright. I don't own this music. I'm just playing it for whatever purpose, right? Does that kind of absolve them of any issues?
Not necessarily. I mean, if they're not using it with authorization,
and
they're somehow deriving some type of benefit from it, maybe driving traffic to their website, to their YouTube site, it would technically be a violation.
Okay. And that's just a matter of whether or not that the owner of the copyright would think it's been worthwhile to go and pursue that person.
Well, exactly.
So what would be the point of them putting, because obviously a lot of them are doing it. It's kind of like attorneys putting those stupid tax warnings on the bottom of their emails.
Right.
No, like,
yeah. I'm not a tax
70% of attorneys put the stupid tax warning that the IRS has said you don't have to do.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the Wizard of Oz. Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so right. Really, that's
I'm not
why
really
doing
it. It's really okay.
So how would, you know, since some of our listeners, and frankly, a lot of attorneys do a lot of that YouTube video nonsense, how would they protect themselves if they're going to use any music? Just make sure it's non-copyrighted?
Well, yeah, you could go through one of the organizations that protects artists performing rights, the performing rights organizations such as BMI and ASCAP, and they control the music of all their members, and the proper way to get a permission is to go through them to either the producers or the record label to do that.
And how would an artist starting out, and we have a lot of bands and whatnot in South Florida, how would they protect themselves from other people using their music from commercial gain? Is it automatic, or do they have to do something?
Well, a copyright, an artist owns copyrights in their works as soon as they create it, fix it on a tangible medium.
So like Gloria Estefan, who created this Miami Sound Machine, when those hits, those huge hits, before anybody heard them, she owned them. There's no way that somebody could supervent that.
That's right.
No one owns the Miami Sound, man.
Hey, now.
There's only one Miami Sound machine. Yep. But, no, the copyrights vest as soon as the work is created. The registration of a copyright is perfecting those rights.
Okay. Kind of like perfecting a lien. Gotcha.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in order to, as a prerequisite to filing a lawsuit, these suits are in federal court, a work has to be registered with the Copyright Office. So it's advantageous for an artist, whether it's music, art, even websites, to register their work prior to publishing it. The reason being is if the work is registered at the time of an infringement, the owner would be entitled to statutory damages. So even if they're not suffering any actual damages,
gotcha, right,
they would still be entitled to some form of statutory damages.
So that's the difference between registering it.
That's right.
Gotcha,
correct.
Gotcha.
You know, we were talking about businesses and new businesses starting, and as a former head of a chamber of commerce, we get calls every single week saying, I have a cease and desist letter, and the Secretary of State gave me this name, and I got my domain name from GoDaddy, and now they're telling me cease and desist. So what's the differences between my business filings and my trademark rights?
Well, the difference is that a state filing for a corporation or LLC does not give any trademark rights to the owner of that corporate name. Mm-hmm. It's just a registration with the Department of State. And so if you go through and you search on SunBiz, you'll see variations adding the words like South or West to, you know, West Acme Auto, South Acme Auto. Just using those, making
Acme
up those names. But Acme. But, you know, so you can get your corporate name or LLC name registered with the state by just slightly changing it. However, with the trademark office, that doesn't work. There are no trademark rights in a corporate filing. Those rights, trademark rights, occur through use of a mark that is recognizable and valid.
Is that one of the services you offer?
Yeah, well,
you set up a company.
I do help my clients set up companies, corporations, as well as all the contracts that go with that. But one of the first things I do with a client is to do a trademark search. Because they are going to want to market their company. Well, let's make sure that name is available
you
in the
bet.
U.S. Trademark Office. It doesn't matter what the state says. It really matters what the...
Because you spend all that money, you spend all that money, brochures, business cards, websites, everything else, then all of a sudden you get the cease and desist.
Yeah.
And guess what? They're probably right to send that to you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. What about the opposite? What if, like, I wanted to go online and start a company called Vanilla Ice Inc.? Would just starting the company be a violation of his mark?
Yeah, that would fall under the rights of publicity, mm-hmm. And those are governed by state laws. But those laws prevent someone from using another's name or likeness for commercial gain.
Well, I meant, you know, him as a brand, not as a person. You know, so Pepsi Inc., you know, I didn't mean to confuse the question. In other
right.
words, if the state will let you do it, is just having that company in that registered legal name, can they come after you and say, hey, you got to change the name of your company?
Yes, they can. Oh, absolutely. And I get injunctions all the time.
So the federal law would be above the state.
Yeah, it would trump the pardon upon.
Not at a rally.
Uh-oh, not at a rally.
Maybe at a Checkers.
That's right. Do you have to be a U.S. citizen to obtain a federal trademark registration?
No, you don't. I have clients in the Bahamas, Saudi Arabia, South America. No, you just have to acquire U.S. rights. The mark has to be used in the United States.
Josiah?
I had one question. You were talking about statutory damages, and I was wondering about that. Sometimes you see all these lawsuits when someone's filing a claim against someone for infringing on their copyright, and I always wondered, how do they quantify that? So do they look and see how much money someone has made as a result of using someone else's name, or, you know, how does that get determined? And, you know,
yeah, but the statutory damages will be based on the willfulness of the infringement.
Okay.
How egregious was the infringement?
Okay.
But they also, in looking at that, to look at the number of units that were sold or produced. And
You mean like Blurred Lines and the Marvin Gaye? They sold right. millions of dollars of that, and yeah. they did infringe apparently, and they lost millions
right.
of dollars.
Yeah, and statutory damages, even though you don't have to have actual damages, if there are actual damages, it's going to increase the amount of statutory damages a court may award.
So you get both.
And if it's willful, I mean, it could be as low as $500 per infringement,
mm-hmm.
up to $25,000 per infringement.
Wow.
So if it's willful, that could be quite a bit of an award if you prevail.
So what about professional work? So, like, let's say an attorney goes on Westlaw or goes on the the docket and pulls a brief and then cut and pastes from that brief to his own brief, you know, besides being lazy, though, or sometimes smart, depending on who you're, the attorney you're taking from, is that copyrightable? I mean, if I write a brilliant brief, is it copyrighted?
Technically, I guess it would be a violation of those copyrights, but to the extent that there's originality in the wordsmanship, but citing cases and using boilerplate legal language that's not necessarily original or is based on someone else's work, there really wouldn't be any rights in that.
Okay.
But you do have, you know, some attorneys very particular in protecting their work. And so when you cite cases in a brief, you're going to put quotes around, you know, what you're citing.
Yeah, I meant kind of taking the brief.
Right. Right. Taking note.
Because you see that. You
can't
know,
do that in law school either.
Why reinvent? Yeah. Well, law school is a different story. What about, like, you know, and this is something you do see a lot, especially on smaller cases, where you'll have, like, a RAMCO form for whatever, and a pro se will, you know, basically take that off online, retype it or whatever, and use this RAM. You know, it's a RAMCO form that they retype because it's wrong in the same ways. Could RAMCO come after them for breaking a copyright in their, you know, because what I'm getting at is, like, a certain type of use exempt, like using it in a lawsuit, using it for health reasons, or is it just any use of the copyrighted work that's bad?
Well, the Copyright Act specifies particular use that considered fair use. There's fair use exceptions to the copyright owner's rights.
Okay.
Those typically involve educational purposes.
Oh, okay.
Things of that nature. Anything that's going to be on the fringes of for commercial gain or affiliation with an organization, things of that nature.
But when you litigate these, they're not in front of a jury, are they? They're in front of a judge.
It could be a bench trial or a jury trial.
Oh, it can be
jury trial. What about textbooks then? If it's educational use, why doesn't everyone just photocopy textbooks?
Gary.
No, I'm really curious about
it. It's called Cliff Notes.
Thank you, Phil. Anyway, why don't people just photocopy text notes? Textbooks.
Well, textbooks are copyright protected.
But it's educational use.
So within the classroom, to a certain extent, yeah, you could do that. But to start reproducing it and distributing, and there's these blurred lines that you eventually cross that would be
at least
a violation.
Gaye. So it's not an absolute exception.
No, there's a number of factors that go into the analysis. The copyright cases tend to be the most difficult because there are a lot of blurry areas in
so
the copyright
nuanced.
Law.
I have a question. Huh. Do you also represent like recording artists? Do you do that? Okay.
Yes.
So I was wondering, sometimes you see artists and they have these certain deals where they don't really own any rights to their product, and sometimes the big company owns it. How would you caution artists when looking or when they come into your office? Do you get engaged with them prior to signing contracts, or is it sometimes are you able to reevaluate the contract and see if they can have an ownership interest in some of the copyrighted material?
Well, preferably they come to me before they sign a contract.
Okay.
And as you'll understand, you know, it's once the contract's signed, it's tough to get out of. So, but that does happen. I went to school in New Orleans, Tulane, for my undergraduate degree, and I became a huge fan of the Neville Brothers.
Okay.
And they were the Meters before the Neville Brothers.
Okay.
And they signed contracts that gave up their rights to their original works.
Mm.
And there was, you know, and there was no backtracking from that.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Speaking of New Orleans, I mean, there's a big rapper there, Lil Wayne.
Oh,
you
sure.
You know, and he's always having lawsuits against this guy named Birdman, who's the owner of his company. And essentially, I don't know what documents he signed, but it's like his boss owns every single piece of his music.
Right. Well, it's most likely it's the agreement he signed, and it wasn't a good one. And when you have artists who are starting out, they're desperate.
Yeah.
You know, and they enter these bad deals. It's best to take a step back and wait and talk to an attorney who does this area of law.
So why isn't that adhesive?
In what way?
You know, the contracts. Why aren't they? I mean, there's a huge disparity in that case for negotiating power. So why wouldn't a contract like that be adhesive?
That's
a lawyer word.
I understand, I know the law school.
No, I know you do. I'm just impressing myself on the audience that I do.
You impressed me.
I remembered it from law school. It just bubbled up.
Yeah. I don't think they're under any being forced to sign those agreements. Mm-hmm. Typically, there's probably some small monetary gain that they get, whether it's $500 or $1,000. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, you know, if it would fall under that, you know, under that exception.
Well, you know, Florida is the center of international distribution. We have these magnificent ports that keep growing every single year. I mean, billions of dollars go through there. And is a federal trademark registration valid outside the United States?
It cannot be enforced outside the U.S., but it can be used to prevent imports of infringing articles from coming into the U.S. But to enforce trademarks outside the U.S., mm-hmm. An owner of that mark needs to register in those particular countries. Europe happens to have a European filing that will allow an applicant to seek rights throughout the European Union, but that's the only region that really does that.
Well, it's almost like the United States. It's getting to be more and more. You know, a more practical question, when someone's bringing these infringement suits, like the example that comes to mind, you go on Amazon and you look for a product and you're seeing, you know, 1,400 different versions of it that all look exactly the same except they have different random letters as brand names. So they're obviously come over from Chinese factories and being branded that way. Is it really that difficult or expensive to bring these suits that a lot of places don't bother, or are they easy suits to bring? Like, why do you see so much violation of patent and copyright without enforcement?
Well, it's one, it's difficult to monitor, and it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, the patent rights and copyrights or trademark rights exist just in the U.S. They're only enforceable here.
Yeah, but I mean, Amazon's bringing them here, you know? Mm. And, you know, I love Amazon, right? So you see it, and they're obviously ripping things off. You know, you go anywhere, you see these purses that look like Louis Vuittons and whatever.
Sure.
Is it really just that hard to, yeah, like Phil's Rolex. Is it really that hard to, is it that hard to enforce?
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, there's companies that actually do that, that go out there and they look for, you know, these counterfeit products.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those types of cases are good for class actions.
Yeah. Gotcha. So is that something you do, like enforce them, or you just protect people?
No, I enforce as well. I litigate in state and federal court.
Are they big cases? I mean, do they go on and on, like, or is it like more like a summary procedure?
Well, it depends. That depends on the company that's being knocked off.
And do you operate on? Do you represent both plaintiffs and defendants?
Yeah, I've represented on both sides of the issues.
And what was the bulk of your practice? What does it make up? Plaintiff, like 40% plaintiff, 60% defense. So
good question.
Yeah, it's probably 50-50.
50-50. Okay.
Yeah. So. It's hard to tell. It just varies throughout the years. But
awesome.
I would say probably, you know, I've been 50% defending, 50% enforcing.
Cool.
Well, you have a degree in engineering.
Yes.
And to me, you can't be an IP attorney without those type of degrees. But you've touched products. You worked on products. Remember, pagers. I mean, I could go on and on. A lot of medical equipment, computers. I mean, these things you actually knew about before they actually came out, or you made them better.
Yeah, in order to be a registered patent attorney, to qualify to sit for that exam, one has to be either an engineer or have a bachelor mm-hmm. of science degree in engineering, science, or some technology. So that's just a prerequisite to sit for the exam.
A BS degree.
A BS degree,
like
indeed.
Most lawyers have that.
All right.
When you got into patent work, do you see the benefits of like your engineering background? Does it help you in the work you do today?
Yeah, it does. Helps me to understand the technology because I was involved in electronics and software, designing test systems that involved hardware and software for testing helicopter parts. So so I understand, you know, the technology. I can speak their language when we're talking and ask the questions that I need answered to understand what they're doing. And
absolutely.
To really, the idea for the thing a patent attorney wants to do is to hone in on what's unique.
Okay.
Awesome. So here's the speed round.
There you go.
So you got a circle R, a TM, and an SM. In 30 seconds or less, what's the difference?
Circle R is a registered trademark.
Okay.
The U.S. Trademark Office. TM denotes common law rights in a trademark. So anybody who starts a business, all they can do is put a TM over their name, and they can assert common law rights. And SM would apply to service marks, to service-based businesses.
So it could be like Gary Singer service mark, it's service based, right. And it could be Phil and TM, but you have to actually register.
And but the SM and the TM are just for common law rights. Only registered marks would be allowed to use the R with a circle.
And if it's common law, is it even really worth putting it on there? Does it matter?
I think it does. It just places the public on notice.
Can you put it on there like patent pending to put the fear of God in people?
Yeah, absolutely. Just place the public on notice. I think it's a good practice to do that.
And speaking of service, if one of our listeners wanted to get a hold of you because they had more questions, how would they do that?
They could reach me at 954-848-2928. That's 954-848-2928. Or contact me through my website at iplawyersusa.com.
Oh, that's so easy. iplawyersusa.com. I don't even have to look to read it.
That's right. On that interwebby thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that, how are we on time?
Is that copywritten? iplawyers.com?
Right. No, it's not.
Well, we know what you're doing after.
Going to be by this weekend.
Well, cease and desist letter.
Yeah. On that note, look, it was great having you on. I want to thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. We're out of time. Most of all, thank our listeners. Thank our listeners. Folks, be safe and
be legal.
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448. For legal news and review, remember, be legal.
Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310 or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.